This Star News Media podcast is presented by North Chase Family Dentistry. Open evenings, Saturdays, and they probably take your insurance. Visit them on the web at northchasefamilydentistry.com.
Hello, and welcome to a new episode of Cape Fear Unearthed, a podcast from Star News Media. I am your host, Hunter Ingram, and I'm a reporter for the Star News here in Wilmington, North Carolina. When you're not joining me each week to talk about history on this podcast, you can find my byline on coverage of the city, the local film and television industry, and my weekly TV Hunter column over at starnewsonline.com. This week, we're flipping to another chapter in our history book of persisting legends, historical oddities, and mysterious figures to talk about what may be the best example of a mysterious figure the Cape Fear region has to offer. As always, I will share with you the story as it has been passed down through history and told through legend. And then I'll bring in someone from the community with knowledge of our tale to continue the discussion and explore whether or not history can be trusted. So settle in for this episode of Cape Fear Unearthed, as we explore the turbulent life, unexpected fame, and untimely death of Robert E. Harrell, the man who would become the Hermit of Fort Fisher. Perhaps more than any story we've told on this podcast so far, the tale of the Hermit of Fort Fisher is likely the one you've heard before. Whether it was through conversation, a historical marker, or a local stage play, the myth and the legend of Robert E. Harrell has become synonymous with this region. A peculiar man, made famous, or rather infamous, by his off-the-grid lifestyle, common-sense philosophy, and untimely death, Robert's eventual status as this area's most unusual resident and tourist attraction in the 1960s and 70s came after a life of tragedy at nearly every turn, until he left it all behind. Robert was born on February 2, 1893, Groundhog Day, in Gaffney, South Carolina, within spitting distance of the North Carolina border. His upbringing was rife with struggle. His mother and two brothers were claimed by typhoid fever when he was just a boy. And after that loss, he took to the woods early on as a refuge from his father and his new stepmother and relatives, many of whom were abusive, both physically and verbally. Eventually, he went to live with religious relatives near Boiling Springs, North Carolina, but still found trouble finding a place where his eccentricities fit the standard of society. He spent countless hours in his formative years working jobs in the cotton fields and at the helm of a small printing press to pay for school, but he never liked being subjected to the will of an employer or an overseer. He married Katie Hamrick, and with their four sons, the couple lived out of a Model T Robert had fashioned into a bus, selling jewelry and odds and ends to pull in what little money he could to feed his family. Their last child, an only daughter, Nellie Kate, died shortly after birth. The family would eventually settle in the foothills, in a home Robert built himself, but it didn't solve their growing staple of problems. It was the Great Depression, and Robert still didn't feel completely content with his place in life. Over time, the tyrant, a word he would frequently use to describe everyone from his stepmother to the government, had begun to show in his own personality, which he used as a volatile defiance against the lack of common sense he saw in the world. A deeper wedge was driven into the family's life around 1935, when his son Alvin threw himself off a railroad trestle after years of struggling to find work and wrestling with depression. Alerted by neighbors of the accident, Katie ran to where Alvin had fallen to find him still alive and trying to crawl back up the ravine to try again. He later died in his mother's arms, according to some sources. Over the next few years, Robert was in and out of mental institutions. One visit was even organized by his influential in-laws as a means of distancing their daughter from her husband. Robert would later tell visitors to the bunker in Fort Fisher that he had long heard voices in his head, criticizing him and disparaging his choices in life. His last hospitalization was Robert's first brush with becoming a legend. And according to that legend, he fashioned a key out of a spoon and fled from the institution in the middle of the night. Katie, meanwhile, had begun to search for her next move, responding to a job post out of Pennsylvania, seeking a live-in housekeeper. She landed the job and packed up the kids to head north, leaving Robert behind to fend for himself. Over the next few years, the couple corresponded through letters. He placed blame on everyone but himself for the breakdown of their marriage and the fracturing of his family. Despite Katie asking why he didn't just make a plea for her to return home, he turned inward and stayed in North Carolina, opening up a watch shop in Shelby. She would go on to marry the man who hired her, a validation of Robert's belief that he had been out to steal his wife. Robert saw Katie as his true love, and he would never marry again. After the failure of the marriage, Robert remained critical of everything. In a letter to his two sons fighting overseas in World War II, he chose not to simply wish them a safe return, but instead expressed his belief that they had been tricked by the government into enlisting. "If you boys think you've won all four freedoms the world over, you have many disillusionments awaiting your return," he wrote. Like many of his previous efforts, the life of a watch repairman wasn't satisfactory to Robert. And in a July 1955 letter to his sister May, he revealed his plan to hitch his way to Carolina Beach and see if he could make it on the coast. "I might consider opening up a shop there," he wrote. "Wouldn't it be fine if we could combine two small shops, one of mountain crafts at Chimney Rock and seaside novelties at Carolina Beach, so we could live and work from top to bottom?" He would never open that shop. As soon as he arrived in the Cape Fear, Robert was living off the land, under windblown trees and at the mercy of mosquitoes. He charged tourists to be their fishing guide and was soon arrested for vagrancy, a charge he sweet-talked his way out of on the condition that he obtain a license to continue his work. He didn't do that either. He eventually became so ill from this outdoor lifestyle that he was forcibly sent back to live with May. But he was back the next summer, at which time he found the bunker that he would call home for the rest of his life. At this point, the bunker was a relic of a lost time in Fort Fisher's history. 13 feet by 19 feet, the small concrete bunker had housed ammunition for Army training operations in the lead up to World War II and was managed in coordination with Camp Davis, located 50 miles from Fort Fisher. After the war, all but one of those structures was destroyed. Where the town and the government had written off the remaining bunker, Robert saw it as a place to call his own. Initially, he faced plenty of pushback from the government, which claimed he was squatting on its property as they were seizing up nearby land to build the Sunny Point military base just across the water. Efforts to remove him, however, calmed after a local lawyer supposedly made the case that the 5-mile radius around the new base actually ended a few hundred feet from the bunker's metaphorical doorstep, and the bunker itself sat on unclaimed land, exposed from the water with the creation of the new inlet. Robert was officially free to stay, though Mother Nature would occasionally displace him with massive storms, like 1958's Hurricane Helene. But that storm's wrath actually opened up a new door in Robert's life. During the storm, the Star News ran a small article noting Robert, now dubbed the Hermit of Fort Fisher, had sought refuge from the wind and rain in Wilmington, showing up barefoot and in his signature straw hat to hunker down in a shelter. The article made its way to Ohio and into the hands of Edward Harrell, his son, who headed to Fort Fisher to reunite with the father he hadn't seen in years. The reunion could have gone better. Edward was shocked by the conditions in which his father was living, with trash and items he had collected over time tossed about in an orderly chaos around the bunker. Edward also quickly learned that Robert hadn't lost his sharp edges, turning the criticism and concerns back on his son, who he said wasn't free because he was bound by obligation to his family of 9 kids. But the terse nature of the reunion didn't alienate Edward. In fact, he would visit his father annually and bring with him his own family. Though he bore the nickname proudly, Robert never actually lived a true hermit lifestyle, which is when someone lives completely disconnected from the surrounding world. Yes, he scavenged food from the wildlife and oyster beds nearby, and learned survival skills from an actual hermit named Impey Hewitt, who also lived among the brush in Fort Fisher. But Robert welcomed company, even keeping a guestbook to record all those who stopped by to visit him. And he used these increasingly robust crowns to dispense his philosophy on the state of the world, and even shared his dream of making enough money to start a school of common sense. People would sit around fires and listen to him teach, preach, or whatever you want to call it. But it was very clear that he was a master of publicity, and he knew how to get the attention of a crowd. He became so popular, one report claims the North Carolina Department of Transportation even considered putting his scruffy mug in their brochures as one of the most popular tourist attractions in the region. And that's because he was. And while he received love and support from spectators, he was also subjected to the cruelty of others. He was frequently robbed of the money and things donated to him, and beaten up by people who would taunt him. On one occasion, he was kidnapped by two people he claimed tried to break his neck and choke him to death in their car. They were tried for the crimes, but they escaped jail sentences. As the region began to grow, more attempts were made to remove the hermit from his pillbox, as it was called. One notable attempt was made by the state's attorney general through Stanley South, an archaeologist who had already met and befriended Robert and who refused to execute the order. In his 10-point reasoning for the refusal, South called the hermit of Fort Fisher a historic site himself, with as many as 1,000 to 2,000 visitors a month during the summer from every state and some foreign countries. In 1971 alone, the hermit claimed 17,000 people came to visit him. But what happens next is where Robert becomes more than just a tourist attraction. Rumors began to spread around this time that he was planning to file a deed for the land the bunker sat on, despite years of dismissing such questions because he didn't want to pay taxes. Developers had also been planning to cram a development on the land around him, hoping to push him out. At this time, attacks on Robert are said to have grown in frequency, with him even telling some friends that he was scared for his life. On June 4th, 1972, five teenage boys stopped by the bunker early in the morning to visit, something they had done before and fully expected to find Robert ready to receive guests. Instead, they found his body in the bunker, the entryway to which was still blocked by the board he used as a makeshift door. News reports of the day mentioned foul play was not suspected, but many in the community didn't buy it, and they still don't to this day. Some say his legs were covered in cuts, he was wet, and his clothes had been disheveled, as if he had been dragged into the bunker. As news spread, the scene around the bunker became chaotic. People came to get a peek at the investigation, friends of his came to mourn, and opportunists came with shovels in hand later that night and in the next days to look for money he might have buried nearby. The death certificate attributed his sudden passing to a heart attack, and despite continued pleas from Edward and Robert's friends, an autopsy was never performed. Stories of locals joking they were responsible circulated around town. Robert's friend, photographer Fred Pickler, who was a forensic technician at the scene, spent years sharing his theory that Robert had been tied up in his sleeping bag and suffocated by the water before being dumped back in his bunker. And still, no investigation was done. His friends, family, and fans were only left with rumors and questions. When Edward came to pick up the few personal belongings of his father, he is said to have been given a couple $100 in change found in the sandy floor of the bunker. More personal items, like papers, were left in the bunker and either taken by Pickler or destroyed. Edward never accepted his father's death being written off as a heart attack. For years, he pled with authorities to investigate and accused everyone from the coroner to the police of a cover-up. 12 years after his death, Robert's body, which had been sent back to Ohio with Edward to be buried, was exhumed for a proper autopsy. the results were inconclusive. But it did find that his heart was in rather good condition for a 79-year-old man. The State Bureau of Investigation was eventually brought in to handle any further inquiries. But the case was officially closed in 1981 due to a lack of evidence. Robert was reburied in Shelby, but in 1989, he was removed one final time and relocated to the Federal Point Cemetery in Carolina Beach, so he could be closer to Fort Fisher. The hermit's story is not an easy one to unpack. Apart from his status as a local celebrity, Robert Harrell was a man estranged from his family because of tragedy and the tyrant within. But he is also an institution in this area's history, the ultimate admirer and companion of the land, who predates the North Carolina Aquarium at Fort Fisher and the now steady stream of tourists visiting the Civil War historic site. For years, locals have tried to reckon with the many facets of his story through books, documentaries, and even a locally written and performed stage play. The Hermit Society was formed in his honor, and in 1993, on what would have been his 100th birthday, Curry Beach declared February 2nd to be Robert Edward Harrell Day. Whatever theory you prescribe to about the end of his life, there's no doubt that Robert Harrell, a man who spent a life searching for his place in the world, as so many of us do, found it in the quiet corner of Fort Fisher. Joining me now to dig deeper into the story of the Hermit of Fort Fisher is Rob Heal, a local filmmaker who directed the Hermit of Fort Fisher documentary in 2006, which featured dozens of interviews with locals who interacted with Robert Harrell over the years. Thank you so much for joining me, Rob.
Thanks for having me, Hunter.
So I want to start out by talking about why you were interested in making this documentary. I know it was a long process for you.
Well, I'm one of your rare natives, and I was in my early 20s, and I had just completed a short documentary that did really well in some film festivals. And my father, who was a journalist, actually worked at the Star News. Back then it was the Morning Star, and he had worked at the Stateport Pilot. We were driving on the beach and kind of having discussion about documentary and what am I going to do next. And he kind of pointed towards the direction of the bunker and said, now that would make a really great story. And I said, you're right. And I really just kind of scratched the surface and this geyser of information just really bubbled out.
So how long was the process for you? I know it took a number of years.
Yeah, we researched it for about a year. We spent a little over a year in production. We edited a version. It took us about another year to edit our first version. That went to PBS and also some film festivals. And then we came back and re-edited it and added in the narration by Barry Corbin. So all in all, I think it took about 7 years.
Okay. What was your initial impressions of Robert? Because he, you know, as all these stories tell, he was a fascinating guy for a number of fascinating reasons.
I really think he was misunderstood.
I think that's a common conception for him.
Yeah, absolutely. He wasn't a hermit. And he really kind of boasted to that effect that, you know, he had 15,000 visitors every year since he had been there, and really liked people. So I think he was searching for some sort of inner peace when he went there. It was much later in his life. He had, you know, he really certainly had a rough life. He really, in some sense, was protecting himself with this kind of cloak of being the hermit. You know, he was kind of like this archbishop of character actors. He would put on his hat and, you know, get out there and do his little hermit spiel. And
he knew how to sell it. Nothing
he did.
Else.
No,
he was a good
absolutely.
Salesman.
He was a wonderful salesman, you know, and that was one thing that he even said he wanted to do. He wanted to promote Fort Fisher. He wanted to take away the emphasis from the hermit and put the spotlight on the wonderful area and draw people down.
That's admirable. I mean, I love going out to Fort Fisher, so I don't blame him for wanting to spend time out there. It's just this, you know, so much of his story is through the accounts of other people, except for those rare people who were able to just sit down and talk to him and kind of
pull his thoughts out of him. I mean, he did like to speak, as I learned when I was researching. What kind of surprised you about the story as you spent all those years researching his life?
Well, you know, everybody's experience seemed to be different with him. Mm-hmm. You know, there were very few people that truly got to know him. And those people that did get to know him called him Bob, you know, and that was something that was really, we hear him called the Hermit, we hear him called Robert Harrell, but there were a few people that really knew him. They addressed him as Bob. He was really kind of had an open door policy. There was always a fire going at his place. People would come down, sit around the fire, you know, have some drinks, probably discuss politics and current situations and life in general. You know, so it was those few people that I think really were willing to spend time with him and delve into the mind of the Hermit. Not the greatest conditions, you know. You're fighting mosquitoes, yeah. You're fighting the elements, you know. So I said, when we were filming the documentary, I spent about 3 hours pre-dawn to set up and capture a sunrise over the marsh, and the mosquitoes almost killed me, you know, so I could not imagine the elements that he had to really endure and live in.
You made this movie, and in the process, you talked to such a wide variety of people, both people who were, you know, residents of this area who visited him as a child casually, you know, more as an attraction as tourists did, but also some people who were very much tied to his story. You spoke to a woman who said she was there the night before he died. You spoke to Fred Pickler, who was very involved, especially after his death, in the investigation and the continual, you know, story that went along with his death and his life. What was it like to talk to these people who knew him and knew him in such a odd variety of ways, I guess?
Well, he definitely touched everybody in a special way. So it was really wonderful to be able to pull out those experiences and then be able to share them with such a broad audience and also introduce the Hermit to people that had never heard of him before. You know, I've gotten emails from all over the country of people that have been fascinated by this man, you know, based on the film that they saw. Mm-hmm. You know, so it was a wonderful experience being able to share those stories and try to dispel some of those myths and rumors and really look at him as an individual and a human being, which I think a lot of people just didn't do. They saw him as a hermit, or they saw him as a nuisance, or they saw him as some sort of like magical individual, you know. So there's so many misconceptions of him, and I think very few people really knew who he truly was.
So much of the myth and the story of Robert is his death, and I think that's a little unfortunate because he did have such a kind of a fascinating life here in the area. But as you were doing your documentary, did a lot of the conversation, a lot of that story tend to kind of go towards the theories of his death or the story of his death?
Oh, absolutely. You know, we could really pinpoint like four theories on his death. And I think we were able to, you know, dispel most of them. There was the idea that the greedy landowners were trying to get him off the land. Well, you know, the construction of any sort of development was halted in like 1965. Mm-hmm. So that went away. There was no one was trying to get him off the land. People were there to rob him. They found about $300 in change, you know. So was there anything to really rob him for? No, probably not.
When he had been robbed multiple times before of little things that people had given him, according to some stories.
But exactly. I mean, people, the robberies would be like grab and dash, you know. Mm-hmm. They would take his change. So it was nothing to get into an altercation for, you know. There were random. There was the theory that random kids on it was their summer break or a senior trip that were down there and possibly had done it. So, and that just didn't really carry any weight either. So, mm-hmm. So the theories in the of his death, you know, just don't really add up to what actually happened.
Well, in the lack of concrete facts, mm-hmm. and especially with something already so people giving so much attention to him and his, you know, unusual lifestyle, people are going to start filling in the blanks with stories that seem, you know, crazy. We see a lot of that in all of the topics that I do on this show. So much of people just kind of filling in history when they don't have the truth there, I guess.
Right.
But you also said that you didn't want to make a whodunit film when you started out.
No, we never intended to, uncover the murderer or bring somebody to justice. That was never our intention of the film. It was really to share his legacy, to dispel some of the myths of who he was and what he was about, and really lift him up. We won the Digital Hollywood Film Festival. It was after the screening, network executive came to me and said, "It's such a wonderful story. Too bad you ended it so sadly." And I was like, "Well, it ended sadly." And we really
tried not to feel the same way about his life.
We really kind of tried to bring it back around to take a real sincere look at what his legacy was. But it's a sad story.
It is. And there is this prevailing theory through a lot of people locally, even if they didn't know him, through stories over time, that there was foul play. Is that kind of where a lot of people that you talk to kind of landed?
I don't think anybody disputes that. Mm-hmm. There was no real investigation done. Mm-hmm. The family attempted to reopen the investigation in the mid-80s, and the SBI, the State Bureau of Investigation, did get involved. They reopened the case, and they did concede that he did not die of natural causes. Mm-hmm. The death certificate states that he died of a heart attack, senile defibrillation, and that was it. He just died of a heart attack and crawled back into his bunker on his own, and that was it. You know, but if you look at the if you look at the photos of the crime scene, if you look at the condition of the body, it's just very obvious that he didn't die of natural causes. That this was some aggressive act towards him that took his life.
Yeah. And in the movie, you know, we mentioned Fred Pickler earlier, who's been a voice. He has a book about this, mm-hmm. and you helped with that. He had a very specific theory that it involved him being drug out to the water and smothered or suffocated. Is that something that a lot of people believe in that particular theory, or is that just another one of those that we just don't really know?
No, I think that's some of the undisputable evidence. You know, we see where his sleeping bag cover ended up. Mm-hmm. You know, it was in the marsh, 100 yards away from his bunker. There was the shoe that was found that was in the marsh near the area that the sleeping bag cover was found. So there was There was a lot of debris, and the earth around the bunker was disturbed. So you can see where there was a struggle, you know. So these things you just can't dispute.
Yeah,
you know, it's there. It's the evidence. That's how it lies. Who, why? There was, like I said, those questions were never even attempted to be answered. There was no real investigation to really identify who did this.
Yeah. It's fascinating to talk about it in that sense, because on this podcast, we've done stories that go back to the 1700s and come up. The earliest we've done before this episode was the early 1900s. Mm-hmm. But we're still within a time period of, you know, Robert's story that people are still alive who knew him. Mm-hmm. And we're kind of seeing that idea of the legend forming, because there was no real investigation. And so you just kind of look back on it, as we do with all these old history stories, of kind of like, why did you not ask questions? Why, when you're so close to it, wouldn't you want to know the truth?
Well, you know, and I still think that there's a lot of information that could lead to those answers.
Okay.
You know, we can look at those crime scene photos, and we can extrapolate now some of the metadata that actually lives in those photographs. And an example is, there's a picture of tire tracks. I don't think it's outside the realm of possibility to take the photograph of those tire tracks, measure them digitally, and try to identify what vehicle could have left those tire tracks. Mm-hmm. So there are those breadcrumbs that are out there that could lead to exposing the killer. And in my experience, after the film was done, I feel like we have found some of those clues that lead that direction to who did it.
Okay.
Maybe there's another documentary in there.
Hey, you know,
maybe we dust this subject off and come back to it and revisit it and see if we can actually find some answers. So that's actually a possibility.
I mean, is that something you'd be open to, I think?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We've had there have been discussions about that in the last few years.
It's been 13 years since you made that movie or released that movie. Obviously, a long time since you, even longer since you started making it. Does this story still stick with you? I imagine it does if you see the possibility of revisiting it someday.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. I don't think there's a day that goes by that I don't think about, you know, Robert E. Harrell. Is, you know, I think there was a lot that I could owe to my career for this film. We were nominated for a few Emmys for it. It really helped launch my career. And kind of looking back and seeing that there might be things that still need to be told and shared about it, you know, in a sense, kind of live with me.
Yeah.
So he started off as a rumor. He became a legend. Mm-hmm. And he's slowly becoming a myth.
And I don't think you're alone with something about him sticking with you. I think a lot of people in this area, especially people who have lived here and are natives, you know, Robert's a fixture of this area and probably always will be.
Absolutely. And, you know, I still, if I just need to get away and clear my mind, I'll hike down to the bunker. I'll crawl up on top of it and have a little conversation with Robert.
There you go. That's exactly what I do. When I need to get away, I go out to Fort Fisher. And I think he was onto something clearly because it's very peaceful out there. It's kind of a, you know, I don't think I could live life as a hermit, but I do appreciate the things that he appreciated about the area out there.
Let's go try.
There you go. You never know. I can let you try, I guess.
No, 30 days in the bunker.
Oh, no. That would be a heck of an article for the newspaper.
There you go. 30 days in the bunker. Live like the hermit.
Wow.
You know? I mean, complete with attacks.
Yeah, exactly. I'd have to learn how to crab, too. So, thank you so much for being here, Robert. I really appreciate it, and I encourage everyone to go watch his documentary. You can find it on YouTube. You can find it in other places. You can find it physically, and I will share it on our Facebook group just so people can see it. It's a really good capturing of his life.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's episode of Cape Fear Unearthed and the story of Robert E. Harrell, or as you know him now, the Hermit of Fort Fisher. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next Thursday with a new episode and another tale from the history books. But until then, be sure to share your thoughts on this week's episode and all of our episodes on Twitter with the hashtag CFUnearthed, or you can email me at capefearunearthed@gmail.com. You can also join our Facebook group, where listeners can ask questions about our episodes and share their own thoughts about the region's history. In that group, I'm always sharing extra content for our listeners, where they can see pictures pertaining to each week's episode, including some from the Star News archives and other sources of Robert and his time as the Hermit of Fort Fisher. You can find that group by searching Cape Fear Unearthed on Facebook. Finally, you can get a list of all the books, articles, and resources used in researching this podcast in the show notes of each of our episodes. Cape Fear Unearthed was written, edited, and hosted by me, Hunter Ingram. You can find more of my work at starnewsonline.com. Additional editing is done by Adam Fish, and this episode and all of this season is being recorded at WHQR Studios in downtown Wilmington. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you stream us to make sure you never miss an episode. And while you're there, make sure you give us a review or a rating. That helps more people be able to find Cape Fear Unearthed. Until next week, get out and explore the Cape Fear region on your own. What you learn might just surprise you.